Welcome back to Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. This week we're back up at the wall with Jon Snow, and I brought on one of my favorite people to talk about Jon with, and that's Arthur Jonfa. Sometimes I give Arthur an email when there's some big event that happens in the plot. I like to get his take on it, and he always has an interesting perspective. The other thing I like about Arthur is that he is not shy about disagreeing with me when I have a pet theory on a disputed plot point. Steve and I continue our rewatch of season 6 and talk about the return of Rickon. Without further ado, here is Arthur Jonfa. Arthur, I think that maybe with this particular chapter, I'm just going to jump right into the synopsis.
Yeah, okay. Please do.
Jon and Sam have gone north of the wall with Lord Mormont and his rangers. They have stopped to study the bodies of two men formerly in Benjen's company. After Riker suggests that the men have been dead for only a day, Sam objects. He suggests that the blood of the men is dry, like black dust, and there's no blood spatter on the ground below them. Even more odd, no animals will go near them except for Ghost. Mormont decides to bring the bodies back to the wall. Once returned, Jon learns that the king is dead and that his father has been accused of treason. Even though Mormont tries to comfort him with wine and wisdom, most others simply stare at him. He overhears Alistair Thorne call him the bastard of a traitor. At this, Jon moves to attack him with a dagger. His friends hold him back so that Alistair survives. But the foolish act lands Jon locked and guarded in a room. That night, he follows Ghost out of the room and finds that his guard is dead. Jon and Ghost climb the steps to Mormont's room where they find and fight Othor's corpse, who has waked from the dead. After much slicing and choking, Jon burns the corpse. So, Arthur Jonfa, what do you want to talk about? You want to talk about a character, a plot point, a theme, or shall you and I climb the Ladder of Chaos?
I think I've become addicted to Ladder of Chaos. So,
well, then you take the first. Yeah, you take the first topic for sure.
Yeah, I'll take the first rung, and I think I want to start not with the obvious. I want to start with Samwell Tarly, because there's a lot of talk about Samwell Tarly being the best character. As in, is he the nicest? Is he the most moral? Is he? There's a lot of big claims about Samwell Tarly going
around. Here's the claim that I make. It's okay. Normally in reaction. It's always a reaction to this common statement that Martin doesn't write black or white characters, but he only writes gray characters.
Yes.
And I always think, like, that's such a simplification.
I mean, I agree.
Certainly there are really evil characters, and certainly there are really good characters. And, of course, the example I always trot out is Sam, right? Mm-hmm. And you're going to nuance my nuance.
Well, yes, I'm going to nuance your nuance because that's what we do at universities.
That's what this podcast does.
That's what this conference is all about. There's a lot of claims about how great he is. Is he? Because if we break it down, we look at where he came from, what he does, I don't think he has an opportunity to get power or to really do anything. To me, you can't. Someone who is incompetent and doesn't have the opportunity. I mean, I love Sam, right? But if he doesn't have the opportunity to be evil, we can't really be like, oh, he's a good guy, because he hasn't done a good action. He's just done nothing.
Uh huh. Well,
am I harsh? This is a very, being harsh. He is brave.
This is a very interesting take, and I think that you are taking this chaos too seriously, because I feel like you've eschewed all logic. are you saying that he simply doesn't have the opportunity to make moral choices?
Yeah. I don't think he has the opportunity to show us that he's evil.
I think you're so wrong on this.
Interesting.
I mean, I think of morality in a different way, I suppose. I feel like every person has, 99 opportunities in a day to make moral choices, even if they're very small choices. And of course, this is a character in a story, right? So we only see certain And he's not even a POV character, so we only see certain opportunities for choice. But, you know, what are some things that Sam could have done that, you know, where it could have gone wrong? I suppose the onus is on me to try to give you an example of this, and I'm not thinking of one right now.
No, I mean, I can say that I think there's a lot of examples where he helps out with John, and he takes a risk there. But And on that point, I would argue that he doesn't really have a choice because it's Death or John. He is linked to John. And so John, I think, is a deeply moral character, right? And we can go to, we're going to talk about John anyway. And I have so much to say about John, but I think in his own survival, when he knows his own survival is linked to John, he actually keeps acting in the benefit of John and whatever John tells him to do. And I think that's what makes him look like the deeply moral character. I don't think he's proven that he is.
Mm-hmm. I think that there's something about Sam's loyalty to John that makes it sort of is this this great banner of his morality. Sort of his sigil is, I'm loyal to John. He's a person without a sigil, but at this point, because he's been disowned by his father. But if he had a sigil, it would be like John's face with a heart around it.
No.
He really does return John's love in that way. You know, he says, I'm going to eschew the religion of my birth and go worship John's gods. And if John says something, I'm going to back John up. And if John is feeling upset because he didn't get to be a ranger, I'm going to give him a little nugget of wisdom that's going to make him feel better. So I think in all of those ways, I think he's choosing to be true to his banner. Maybe Martin doesn't put him in these sort of moral forks like he does with other characters.
Mm-hmm.
Like we always see Ned's entire narrative is this moral fork. Like,
yes. No, I think he doesn't. So
you're saying because he's not in those situations, maybe our love for Sam is a little bit naive.
Well, I guess here's how I see outstanding morality, right? Because there is saying Sam's a good guy, and I agree. Uh-huh. And then there's saying he is the most moral guy in this book, or he's the nicest person. Here's how I see outstanding morality as, would I do it? Right? Would I run into this burning, I mean, this is obviously a cliche, right? But would I run to this burning building and take out this pug? Well, I wouldn't, because I wouldn't die. But this guy is an extremely moral guy, and he decides that it's worth the risk. I don't feel like with Sam Tarly that in his space, I wouldn't have done what he did, right? Or that, I don't know, someone with neutral morality wouldn't have done what he did, because I see his loyalty to John as something that makes emotional sense, and that is tied to his own survival. And I don't see what else he would have done, right? I mean, unless he was making an evil action, but it doesn't strike me as like extremely moral. Whereas when I look at John, if we're going to transition to him, I'm thinking, whoa, he's doing things I would never have done. He's taking risks for more reasons that I wouldn't have done.
But well, I guess okay, I think that we've sort of found a middle ground on this. Centrist. You've coaxed me a little bit closer to your force of gravity in this case. I like that conversation because I do feel like, well, I do think that Sam in some ways is a stand-in for Martin. Like I think in a lot of ways Tyrion is a stand-in for Martin. But I don't think that that's necessarily true. I think Martin, as a lot of good authors will do, is he'll write himself into a lot of characters.
Yes, but it'll be
specific aspects of these characters. And I think that he sort of has gifted Sam with some of the things that he's most uncomfortable about himself.
Mm-hmm.
But Sam also is very smart, right? And he's a very, very bookish. And he can, like you say, he can be brave in certain ways.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you this? Have you ever written fiction?
I'm trying. I've often tried. I've started several projects. I'm just into a project now that I intend to finish. It's a very different I've written a lot of books, but it's a very different process. And I have started to feel certain sympathy for Martin, you know, trying to take this massive epic landscape and bring it to conclusion. I realized how difficult that is, even with a simple story. But why do you ask?
Are you writing yourself with the characters? And if so, what they look like?
Yeah, right. That's a good question. Yes, and then I realize that I'm doing it, and then I try to hold back a little bit here and there if I feel like I'm doing it too much or doing it without reflection or something like that. I do want to talk about zombies. So you ready to talk about zombies?
Yes.
So this chapter, it's interesting the way it's situated because the book has sort of fooled you into thinking that all of the juice, you know, all of the interesting details, all of the interesting plot is in the South now. You know, it's like, you know, Rob is about to ride south, and Kat has captured Tyrion in the South, and Tyrion has escaped in the South, and all of Ned's plot is in the South. So it's like the North is being drained of plot. And even in this chapter, you kind of get this little sleight of hand where it's like, actually, John was worried about the corpses and he's worried about Benjen. But when he hears that his father's been accused of treason, now all of his mind is going south.
True.
And then by the end of this chapter, you realize, no, this book has tricked me. The real plot is north of the wall. And Asha is about, you know, Asha's about to remind us of this in the next chapter. But until this point, we've been fooled into thinking that all of the interesting plot is happening in the South. And I think that it's because we really haven't seen a whole lot of supernatural in this book yet. The only thing that we got that's seemingly supernatural, you know, definitively supernatural so far, are these others that we meet in the prologue, right? And now we finally meet a zombie in this chapter, and you realize this is not a detective novel. This is a fantasy novel. Or this is a horror novel or something. Anyway, I thought that it was a very effective little magic trick.
It's effective, but I guess the question is, why is he doing it this way, Martin? Because he opens with this. He's not trying to build in. He's not trying to build intrigue on if this will be supernatural, right? So we know there will be some supernatural.
We know, but he's made the Southern politics so interesting that it's kind of somewhere in the back of our mind, but it's not the thing that's most interesting so far in this book. So it's not necessarily that he's sort of revealing something new. It's like a magician. He's made us interested in the wrong hand enough so that when he brings in the trick, we have been sufficiently fooled. And we're, you know, happy to go along with it, you know, just like an audience for a magician will be willing to go along with it. But maybe you weren't fooled.
I don't think I wasn't fooled. I think I read the book after I watched the first episode of Game of Thrones. Actually, I was doing it at the same time. And I, knew about what was going to happen.
Well, it's not like I didn't know it was going to happen. It's just that when I'm immersed in the narrative,
of course,
I can kind of suspend my future knowledge just to sort of appreciate what's going on in the story right then and there.
Yeah, I guess I experience it as like a Dora the Explorer moment where there's like, where is the white? And I'm like, it's there, it's in front of you, he's got blue eyes. You idiots. So, yeah, it's kind of like the characters catching up with what you already know, which is fun.
Sure, it's good.
Can we go back to the zombies? Because I have a lot of opinions about zombies.
I was
having a conversation with the zombies with my friends, and I realized that the conception of how zombies function is very important. The question was, if you had a zombie apocalypse, what kind of zombies would you have, right? And I was saying that I want traditional zombies, that eat brains come out of like thriller style. They only, I don't want no brainwashing virus nonsense, none of that. That's too modern. I wanted them to come out of the grave.
Yeah.
To eat brains, but I realized that wouldn't work because
you're really sort of a zombie purist.
Well, yeah, exactly. I had to like to think myself of like the Puritan of the zombie world. And
okay,
I just realized that would not work because these zombies, there was firstly not enough of them, and then they would just kind of wander around quite slowly because they're not running. No zombies run. Okay, again, that's nonsense.
Yeah,
against my purist mindset. So. I think it's an interesting choice of how you make your zombies and how you decide.
So you have a problem with Othor, I think, is what you're saying, because Othor is not a traditional zombie. Othor, it seems, knows to seek out Lord Mormont and go for the head of the organization. That's how I'm reading this. Like Othor is sort of playing... He's playing possum. Do you guys have that phrase in France and England? Playing possum?
In England, yes. In France, no.
Okay. All right. Well, anyway, he's pretending to be a dead person, and he gets snuck into the wall. And when he wakes up, he doesn't just start eating brains of anyone in sight. He's specifically going to Lord Mormont's room. So this is not a traditional zombie. This is a strategic zombie. And we find out elsewhere in the book that sometimes, you know, men will go out, become zombies, and then come back to their home and try to, like, do zombie violence on their wives. So there's something about, I don't know, the sentinel mind that isn't completely eclipsed in these zombies. Or they're just pawns in some sort of mastermind. White Walker is sort of controlling them.
Are you trying to make a moral case for the whites, saying that we should give them rights, that they're misunderstood?
We need to rehabilitate the whites, Arthur. Come on. Maybe we've judged them too harshly. They need a Norwegian style of prison rehabilitation.
Is anyone trying to talk a white out of it? That's the real, like, because we were just at war with the whites. Did we actually just be like, oh, do you want a territory, Night King? Sure. That's all he wanted, is a kingdom. He wanted the Eighth Kingdom.
Yeah. So anyway, I thought that was interesting. It's always kind of like made me think, oh no, these are zombies in the way that I can recognize them as zombies, but they're certainly not your Arthur Jumpa purity zombies.
Yeah. And I think that's...
So does that make you like this a little bit less?
Yes, I mean slightly. But on the other hand, I would also say that it makes me slightly a bit more, so I think it levels out. Because I think it's appropriate to the scene, right? We have, this is ultimately, there's a lot of political intrigue and there's a lot of crime intrigue, and it's a very, like, the interpersonal relationships, these things matter a lot in this book. And so if you had just mindless zombies, if you didn't have, they have a king and they have an army, and each of the whites actually can think individually and kind of remember what happened before, this means that we can have white spies and you can have white generals. And I think that's important, because otherwise it would make them utterly boring compared to, even if they were a massive threat, that wouldn't be enough to make them interesting.
Well, and I guess here's the other thing about this, is that there is something akin to what happens with John eventually.
Right? Mm-hmm.
He's brought back to life. There's something about him that is undead. He's lost some of his humanity.
Mm.
And yet he's recognizably Jon Snow, at least in the series.
Right.
And you could probably say the same thing with Lady Stoneheart, right? So she's something that's undead.
Mm-hmm.
And yet she's recognizably sort of a vengeance monster who's thinks strategically. So whatever's going on with these zombies is not unlike what happens to these other characters.
So what if it differentiates them? Is it because Lady Stoneheart and John can talk?
So we have to remember that there's sort of this ice magic and fire magic, right?
Right.
At least in the series, John is brought back by the fire magic.
Yes.
So it could be the rules are a little bit different. But we do have, like, for instance, there's this character that they call Cold Hands, mm-hmm. who, like, rides a big elk, and he helps Gilly and Sam escape. And he seems to be something that's undead, and yet he's sort of trying to help the living in some way, in a way that seems to be at odds with the zombie pawns on the chessboard.
Okay, so I've come to the conclusion that they're not zombies, that there's some kind of undead life form. But yeah. I guess what makes them dangerous is that they're aggressive and want to eradicate all humans, but maybe they have some kind of... They're not quite zombie-like, right?
All right, they're not quite zombies. However, they're definitely dead.
Mm-hmm.
They look dead.
Right. They eat brains.
Well, anyway, there are certain ways that they present as zombies. Yes. But clearly, the rules are different. They don't know about viruses. They know about magic, right? So this is a magical zombie for some. I don't know if that helps. So
yeah, and I think it takes a lot of creativity, and it's very well. I think what Martin's doing is very smart, right? He's using the zombie trope, but he's kind of adapting it to his world wonderfully. I think so.
So Mormont at one point says something to John. It's in the context of John finding out about, you know, the king's dead and your father's been accused a traitor.
Mm-hmm.
And Mormont says something that really caught my attention. He says, the things that we love destroy us. Remember that.
Mm.
And I thought, this is exactly what happens to Mormont. You know, he's devoted his life to the Night's Watch. And eventually, he loves the Night's Watch, and eventually the Night's Watch will destroy him. So I thought that was a nice little foreshadowing of the Lord Mormont demise.
It's also what happened to Mormont before this, right? With his son, he's here partly because his son betrayed him, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And is it potentially past the books what might happen to John?
No, this is exactly what happens to John.
Yeah.
The way that dance ends is that we find out that
Night's
Watch kills John too, right?
True. And I guess I was thinking of Daenerys, but yes, also that's true.
Right. And I guess the other thing you could say with John is that he's fallen in love with sort of the free folk culture, right?
True.
He wants to save the free folk. Very literally, he's fallen in love with Ygritte, right?
Mm.
And this has made him something. He's sort of embracing his first men roots. So he's fallen in love with that. And then, of course, bringing them south of the wall is probably what gets him killed in the end. So I think you could read that in a number of ways. What were you saying about Danny? You were making a point about Danny.
Yeah. I was saying that perhaps the same thing happens to Danny, where he falls in love with Danny, and so this is past the books, right?
Right.
But I'm guessing the idea is that his ultimate love, he'll have to.
She falls in love with him, and then
she betrays
he'll
her.
Kill her.
But she also betrays him. He has to do that because she's betraying him in the way she's acting, right?
Right.
I'm fascinated by the way that Martin by Design created a political world where really the most important actors are the leaders, right?
Yeah, and of course.
Right now, in how nations interact, like, that's not really how we think it works, right? I guess my first point is that realistic? Because I study like how nations fight and have conflict between each other, and it's interesting to see that actually here is it's all about, well, one person's going to make the decision. Well, actually, that might not be how that works. And then the second is, well, once you have that world, you throw in it the perfect person, the perfect leader, John, and then you see how that interacts. And I guess my question is, Also, do you think John is the perfect leader?
Yeah, there's a lot there. I think that leaders do matter. I don't know that Martin, I don't know if the world that Martin has created adequately makes the point that you're making. You know, that actually, politically speaking, it's actually collective forces, you know, social forces acting in collective that sort of guide the leaders in many cases, right? So I don't know if that's the story Martin's telling, at least in this first book, right? And so Martin's more interested in sort of people who were once leaders, or people who could have been leaders, or people who might be leaders if they play their cards right, or people who are leaders, but they're not, you know, actually there's someone behind them who's really sort of pulling the strings. That's the kind of story that Martin's interested in telling. And he's absolutely telling that story with John's narrative, right? You know, here's this guy who actually has a claim on the throne. He has a claim to the throne. He doesn't know it. And maybe because he doesn't know it, maybe this is part of it. But at the same time, he cares about doing the right thing more than most characters in the story. He's a person with actually a lot of power who's sort of convinced himself that he doesn't have a lot of power. And from one perspective, you could say, like, well, yeah, maybe that's a good thing for him, because if he believed in his own power, then it would sort of corrupt his decision-making skills. He would be making decisions to accumulate more power, because that's what power does. But here's this guy that's convinced himself that he has very, very little power. And because of that, he cares. He cares about what the right thing to do is. You know, he doesn't want to father a bastard, because he doesn't want to put anyone through the life that he's lived. And he wants to take the oath, and he wants to live by the oath. And he wants to tell the truth, and he wants to lash out against injustice if he sees it. Does he do those sorts of things if he was raised like Joffrey, right? So I don't know that that's, I don't know if it's true. Think it could be both are true. It could be that part of what makes him a good person is that he doesn't have entitlement. But then again, you could also go the other way. You could say, well, he actually did have the opportunity for feeling that way. He was raised under the wing of the most powerful man in the North. Sure, surely his proximity to power would make him hungry for more power. So you could go either way on this one. I don't know if that quite answers the point that you're making,
No,
though.
it absolutely does. And I guess the question I'm asking that question is because when I read the book, my initial thought was at the same time I was studying how leaders worked and how nations interacted and how regions interacted and how leadership was important. And I thought, you know, maybe we're underestimating leadership because this really feels like to me like a realistic estimation of how political intrigue might work. And you know, we even study ourselves Game of Thrones, so that again we're not too depressed.
Yeah, sure.
And I guess what I was thinking was, okay, so not only is this super interesting, but also gave me hope. Like there has John to me, there has to be someone like John, right? And so I guess I disagree with your point where I think John is a person that simply is on purpose someone with an ideal moral compass, right? Which is achievable, right? I mean, you can talk about education, but
Yeah,
I think that's
sure.
achievable. And maybe we underestimate leadership, and so therefore we don't really take as much care of other leaders. And I think John is one of those people that actually is an amazing leader, and he has a huge impact on the organization he's taken leadership on. And I think there's a lot to learn from that.
Right. Yeah, no, I mean, I guess if you're going to look at the structure of the Night's Watch, you know, Mormont is sort of this very top-down kind of guy. You know, he actually puts people in, you know, he says that there's, you know, you leave your families behind, but who are the people that are actually in charge? You know, Aemon comes from wealth and status, And, you know, Sir Jeremy Riker, they're still calling him Sir, right? So his status is actually important, and they keep their surnames at the wall. So status actually is a big part of the wall. And so it's a very top-down model.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, Mormont... I was about to say something stupid. What I was about to say is Mormont's willing to listen to these, you know, these green boys, you know, when other people would sort of brush them off.
Mm-hmm. Why is that stupid?
Both the boys are from high, you know, Samwell is the son of a great lord, and Jon Snow is the son of Ned Stark by everyone's estimation.
He doesn't listen to Pip, does he?
He won't listen to Pip. He's going to listen to these boys. He's going to give Jon the role of his personal steward and groom Jon to be the next Lord Commander. So I don't know. I think this is... I almost convinced myself, but I don't think I ended up convincing myself.
Right.
Martin's story is very antiquated in terms of sort of leadership philosophy.
Yes.
And I think, I don't know if he's done this on purpose or maybe he's done it to antiquate the text or whatever. But there's a reason why most of these POV characters are highborn, I think.
Yeah.
Because he has a particular view of how the world works, how great moments in history are affected by the great men of history, that kind of thing. You know, that someone's bloodline matters. This is all very, you know, neo-romanticism. This is not informed by a history from below for the most part.
Would you agree, though, that John is the perfect leader? Do you just think he's just a highborn man that doesn't need to do much? Like the same way I'm Samwell, I'm just like, well, he's a useless man, you can't do much.
Well, of course there's no such thing as a perfect leader, right? So but I think that the way that he's written in the novel is definitely supposed to engender my empathy, right? It's supposed to attract my empathy. Like, I feel for John. He's a good guy trying to do the right thing. Of course he's better than Joffrey, right? Let's get rid of Joffrey. We'll put someone like Jon on the throne, and then, oh my gosh, he actually has a claim to the throne. So I'm gonna throw my weight behind this guy. Yeah, that's how it's written. I think that's how I'm supposed to read it. Anyway,
fair enough.
So, hey, notable introductions in this chapter. Othor, we never heard him named before, so we see Othor's introduction.
Mm-hmm.
We also see Othor's sort of second departure at the end of the right.
Doesn't it end with we don't know if he's dead?
Yeah, John is sort of praying, like, I hope he dies. I hope this kills him. Right? We're not quite sure of the rules of the magic yet. We don't know that fire will kill a white
exactly
quite yet. But anyway, we do see his departure in a sense.
And actually, to reveal more embarrassing things about myself, that happened, skipped to the next chapter to check that he was dead, like I did with Daenerys when Khal Drogo, his life was saved. I skipped to the next Daenerys chapter to check that everything was okay, because I can't handle intrigue.
You can't handle it. You need the closure now.
Exactly.
You're the kind of guy who like opens up his gifts at Christmas and then rewraps them because you just can't wait.
No comments. If my mom is listening, no
comments. Uh-huh. Yeah, I got it. Also, this phrase spirit summer, we haven't heard that before. And then there's just a bunch of characters. Jaffer Flowers, Bast the Kennelmaster, Hake. These are all named characters that are introduced in this chapter. I couldn't find much in terms of show versus book difference. Did you see anything?
I actually haven't thought about that.
The one thing that I came up with was that I don't think in the show. Well, so go ahead.
I guess the difference is in the show, ghost is the one that saves Mormont's life, literally, as in he leads John to Mormont.
Right.
And he doesn't do that in this. He just scratches on the door. And then,
well, yeah, so he indicates that there's something wrong behind the door. But then, of course, once they open the door, Ghost waits for John to start up the stairs.
Yeah.
So that's a difference. The other thing is that when he confronts Alistair Thorne, he, like, gets on top of the table. He sprints across the table and kicks a bowl of stew out of his hand, right?
Mm.
That's not how it's framed in the show. But other than that, this is a very... This chapter is very much represented in the show. And then notable departures, of course, Othor departs in a way. So,
and all the other people that have just been introduced but to be dead. How does Martin come up with these names? I mean, famously, he has an unlimited number of characters in his books. And now he's introducing names for people that are just dead. I mean, no wonder he can't write any more books. He's run out of names.
Well, I do know, I have heard him interviewed on this point before, because it is impressive. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely impressive. I mean, he claims to just crack open these tomes of history and find names that are no longer in use.
Oh.
But I also know that he will do an homage here and there to someone he likes. Like, I don't know... But I'm pretty certain that Jeremy Riker in here is an homage to Star Trek.
Hmm.
You know, here's this guy who's kind of second in command. You know, he's a knight. I think, you know, it's not spelt like, you know, Commander Riker spells his name. But I see a name like that and I think, yeah, that's a little homage. Like he'll do this with like he's really into music. He'll name people after musicians. So famously, I think that the Weirwoods are sort of a nod to Bobby Weir from The Grateful Dead.
Mm.
Let us...
An encyclopedia of everything Martin's ever said, which is very useful for the podcast, but I wonder when you listen to
it. I'm not... I know. I don't know nearly as much. I just... I've seen a few interviews, and so I haven't seen... I mean, you could go. There are archives. People have the. I guess it's the Spake Martin archive, or the So Spake Martin archive, where people will document everything he's ever said in an interview.
Yeah,
it's a little bit cult. It's a little bit cult like. So
hey, do not say that about listenership. He takes it back. Don't listen to him, guys.
Days, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
And now Steve and I cover Oathbreaker. Here we have the continued training of Bran Stark, who's looking back into Lyanna's narrative. Ramsay continues to strengthen his hold on the North. Jon presides over the hanging of those who murdered him. And yes, the return, with all of the implications involved, of Rickon. Here is comic Steve Osborne. Steve, Ricky Walnuts is back.
He's, yeah. And I'm assuming I'm supposed to be moved.
I think he ate all the walnuts.
He gave himself up. So he's like, I'd rather have no skin than no walnuts.
He was out. It's winter, so it's like there's a limited number of walnuts. And he basically ate them all, and then he figured, I'm done.
He's just convincing OSHA. Look, I've got a little sack of walnuts back at Winterfell.
I had them in the crypts. We'll sneak in.
We just can't go back.
We'll be in, we'll be out. No one will ever see us.
Oh, okay, OSHA. You go find me some walnuts then.
Yeah. No, it's a heist style.
He killed his own direwolf. Maybe there's some in the neck. And that's when they found them. They didn't actually kill the direwolf when they captured him.
Oh, no. Shaggy Dog was...
Shaggy Dog.
He swallowed a walnut. They were just trying to get the walnut back.
Yeah. It'll pass. No, it won't.
So he's back. And I'm sure that he's going to bring all kinds of intrigue to the show.
Yeah, but this is the very, very long con of Ricky Walnuts ascending to the Iron Throne is finally starting to materialize.
I would like Ramsay to finally meet his match.
That's right.
Like, Ramsay can break almost anyone, but Ricky Walnuts is just like his nemesis.
I love it. Yeah, that's the metaphor, right? Is Ramsay's just like can't seem to break a walnut open. Ricky just looks at it with his bare hands, goes, wham! And he's like, so.
The tables have turned, sir.
You fast forward to the next episode. Ramsay's is just getting like his fingers cracked one by one by Ricky Walnuts.
I'm glad he's back. I mean, they had to wrap it up somehow. It was not like that OSHA Rickon faction could just get lost in the wilderness and we never hear from
them. I mean, it could. It kind of did. And since I wasn't, you know, following the show real time, so I wasn't on all the forums and the message boards that were just like, if I don't get Rickon in the next three episodes, look, I lived through the Red Wedding. You killed Shireen. Look, I've been very patient.
Let me just sum this up for you, Steve. People really care about Shaggy Dog. They don't give a shit about Ricky Walnuts.
Right. And now that we know what the fate of Shaggy Dog is, they're like, yeah, skin him.
Yeah. So, yeah, dismemberment count. Shaggy Dog loses his head. Which, you know what? You got to name your animals well. Because if you name them well, you're going to take them more seriously. If you let your kids name your animals and, they're going to have shitty names and you're just not going to respect them.
Yeah. My niece had a cat that had like some gold type fur. So its name was Sparkling Gold. That's arguably the worst animal name in the history of animal names.
What was it? Sparkling what?
Sparkling Gold. Yeah. I remember, you know, and she was young and, you know, trying to be a good uncle. And they're like, his name is Sparkling Gold. And I said, I'm not going to call it that.
So what did you call it?
I just, as far as I was concerned, the cat didn't exist.
See, this is what I'm talking about.
See?
The next thing, that cat's going to end up without a head, and it's going to be your niece's fault. No one wants to blame 100%. Rickon for that.
No, but everybody, yeah. Oh, no, poor Rickon. It's like, well, he should have thought of that when he mailed in the name. So what, yeah, just so curious. I mean, you had your finger on the pulse of the fandom. Did anybody give a rip that Rickon was back?
Nope. I mean, there's always one guy that's like, you know, chimes in and says, well, what about Rickon? So there's always that.
And then that, he gets banned from the message
board. But yeah, but I'm telling you, there's like an army of Direwolf fans, and Rickon maybe had like little balcony section of fans. So yeah, no one cares. But it does give Ramsay leverage, right?
Leverage, yeah. Oh, for sure.
Because you think, you know, Sansa's gone. He's lost a bit of leverage there.
Right.
So now he's got Ray. And you know what? To be honest, I'm okay with this. I'm okay with the trade.
Oh, sure. Now, if you're going to, now Rickon serves a purpose, even if it's not for very long. So that's fine. And also there's this, but I would love it if it came down to it, like the feeling in the Stark family is the same as like the Game of Thrones message boards. Like they got Rickon and
John's like, who?
Yeah.
Oh, John's, oh, Rickon.
He's the one that can't walk. No. That's Bran.
Rickon's the one that likes the walnuts.
Not ringing a bell. No, he's the other brother. Other brother of who? Of me. Was there another bastard? No, he's the youngest Stark. No.
Not ringing a bell.
You almost have that moment when Arya's getting smacked around about how many brothers she has. It was that she forgot Rickon.
That's right. She lies about the number of brothers. And it was just an honest mistake. She just forgot Rickon.
Yeah, everyone else is like, no. You have another one. I don't think so. Smacks her again. No, I don't. The walnut kid. No, I'm pretty sure he's a Greyjoy.
All right. So overall feelings about episode 3, I felt like, I mean, it's hard to pay off a resurrection. Because everyone on the screen is going to act too normally, or they're going to like overact.
Right.
I thought this was brilliant. I thought everyone.
It was great, man. I think that everybody played it with a right amount of like reverence and not sure.
And freaked out. I mean, it's like this is the problem with the Jesus narratives. Not enough people are just freaking out.
They're like, he's back. He's going to sing. He's going to sing.
I tell you what, Steve, if I needed anyone to give me a pep talk after I spent, you know, 3 days dead, I'd want Davos to give me the pep talk.
Davos is like the king of speeches and advice and the whole thing.
He's always got the same premise. His premise is, look, I don't know shit. Let me just preface everything by saying, I really shouldn't be here. I got no fingers. I don't know what I'm talking about. Yeah.
But at some point, you got to be like, you know what, man? I think you know you give pretty good speeches because you never stop. You never, ever stop. There's no conversation with you. It's just look. You're either reading poorly, or you're pontificating wisely.
But I would want to, man. If I rose from the dead and I was freaking out because you know I rose from the dead.
You know what I feel like every. And this has been. And I'm surprised I haven't brought it up yet. But every time Sir Davos is doing one of his, you know. I'm just doing my best to give you my advice. I'm always reminded of the scene on the ice with Ra's al Ghul in Batman Begins when Liam Neeson is just like non-stop advice.
Yeah, that's right.
Your chest. Rub your chest so you stay. It's like, oh, that rub your chest moment. It's like, you're just like, okay, dude, you're smart. Just let me shiver for a second.
Yeah. It's really hard to do a training montage. And we had that a little bit with Bran in the cave. A lot of Yoda stuff happening with Bran.
Yeah.
Because Yoda's a little bit the same way. Like, Yoda never makes small talk. And
not well, he is when he's pretending to be just some sort of like little like swamp imp or something.
Well, he'll fight your droid for a candy bar.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's small talk. I mean, that's just a different sort of narcissism, I think.
Yeah, it's not necessarily wisdom, but it's just like, this is why you don't question him.
So John gets a pep talk from Davos, who basically says, you know, it's a standard pep talk. I don't know shit, but look, why don't we try to get through this day and not try to be horrible people? I mean, that's right. Basically.
Like, well, he gives it. Well, go fail again, and it's like, that's your closer? I mean, the whole idea that's his closer. Look, no, you're gonna fail again. Let's go do it. That's what I'm saying. I don't want to do actually. Like, that's the thing. You argued against me by saying
you're not helping.
I don't want to fail because I already failed. Well, couldn't, but you get to do it again. That's not.
And then John.
That's why I'm mad. I'm alive.
John walks out the front door and it gets the size of his penis ridiculed by Tormund.
Right. Which
so
is,
clearly know, he fails again.
Exactly. He walks right. It's like, he's like, man, I just, like, if there was a moment where you're like, I just cheated death. And he goes, you have a little dick. Ah, geez, that's worth coming back for.
Yeah, you got to take that loss. I mean, there's not much you can do. He's talking in front of everyone, too.
And Tormund is just like, and you think that he's like, he's ribbing a buddy. But really, he's like, oh, good. I forgot to say that before he died.
Tormund was saving that little zinger. And he was kind of bummed out that he never got to say it while he was alive.
I was hoping to say it before I thrust the sword into you. But now I don't know if that'll ever do anything. So.
All right. We talked a little bit about. All right. So Bran is going through his. You know, Jedi training.
You tell me what he's going through.
He's getting a little Jedi training. He's in a cave. He's with a tree man.
He's looking at the path. He's looking at all over, right? So
yeah,
is he only in the past? Is that what I'm understanding? Has he gone to like the present at all, or like an alternative present? Or
so far we've only seen the past in the show. However, I think that in season 4. There's this scene where he grabs a weirwood tree, like in the middle of nowhere.
Right.
And they show you things that are clearly past, but things that are clearly future as well.
Right.
I think he sees same image that Danny saw in the House of the Undying of like the Iron Throne being covered by snow or ash or something like that.
Right. Fascinating. The concept that we've seen, like Melisandre is all about visions of the future.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have this contrast of Bran is really dwelling into the past. And I don't know enough about obviously what the end goal is or what it, but there is a certain sense of poignancy, right? I would think in terms of the method that's going on, like looking into the past has to have some sort of, must have a greater impact on the future.
Well,
then knowing the future, because the past you can both are now having to be interpreted, but at least one you can see where one led to where you are now, and that might glean something where you're going forward. Whereas if you see a glimpse of the future, you've skipped over how you got there, and so you don't really have a clear picture of what it is you're looking at, you know, because there are things missing.
Well, I think you nailed it, and I think that the fact, I mean, it's also interesting. For these in-world characters, it's also an interesting bit of storytelling because talking about the past of the Starks, it always revolves around Lyanna Stark.
Mm-hmm.
It's like Lyanna Stark is, you know, riding the horse in a circle at Winterfell. Lyanna is supposed to be up in the Tower of Joy, and then Ned's going to try to rescue her. So clearly she's important for the narrative in some way, and the showrunners or the storytellers or whatever are trying to kind of hit you over the head with that.
Right. But we still don't know. We don't know why, right? I mean,
we don't know why. All we know is that it was Robert. The whole reason that Robert tried to overthrow the Targaryens in the first place is because she had been kidnapped by this Targaryen guy, Rhaegar. And so Ned thinks that she's up in like a slave up in the Tower of Joy, but then there's an alternative story that maybe she was in love with Rhaegar. So all of this is to kind of say is like the show is kind of beating you over the head with this idea that something about her story is going to be important in the future, right?
Right, and obviously we don't know anything because like the people that know anything about her are just, you know, getting clipped off here, right? I mean,
they're getting clipped off. We're not really sure who else knows this whole secret about Lyanna Stark.
Okay,
but anyway, seemingly you would think that Bran has the wherewithal to find this out. Right.
Yeah.
The other thing that in that scene that was interesting was that he yelled father.
It appears as though he impacted the past. So it's more than a vision.
Or if you want to get really timey-wimey about this, Steve, he always was in the past.
Yeah. No, there's that. Okay, so this is going to be...
Because Tree Spirit Yoda says that the ink is dry. You really, really can't rewrite the past. Suggesting, in other words, that maybe Ned just heard the wind, right? But Bran seems to know better. Right?
Yeah, so speaking of going back in time, let's go back in time to the beginning of this podcast when I'm very weary about magic. They've done a really good job of warming me to dragons and resurrection to the point where I don't think we've really talked about any objections about magic for me at this point, because they've done a good job of giving like rules and boundaries and, you know, hey,
had a bit of objections to the smoke baby here and there.
Yeah. But then the idea that like, oh, you've only got a finite amount of smoke babies. I'm like, all right, I can live with that. You know,
They've done a good job with magic.
Yeah. Well, one thing that I continually have an issue with, even in movies I like, is time travel. Anytime the space-time continuum is interrupted, it creates too many, in my opinion. Like, but you can't, then how did you get, then? But like, it's a loop, then how did it loop? Mm-hmm. You know, so, you know, if it's the whole thing, right? So like, if you're telling me that Bran... either interrupts the past either by having like been there like in some other plane, which gives the ability, so he likes, okay, Ned turns around, so that voice was there when Ned was that age, but Ned hadn't had him yet. Like, this is where we get into a problem, like because I doubt that the show can handle, like, this is where I feel like we're
Steve,
watching Lost.
look Steve, as long as you return the Infinity Stones to the place where they were before you took them, everything's fine. That's how it works.
I know they tried. Boy, Avengers sure did try. You start giving me Lost elements, and I start to peel away a little bit.
Yeah. Here's how I take this. I think I'm supposed to read this as Ned's walking up the Tower of Joy steps. He hears someone yell, "Father." He turns around, sees no one there, thinks, "Oh, well, that's weird," and keeps going. Mm-hmm. And as people will generally do with things they don't understand, they'll think, it was the wind. They'll reinterpret it in their memory to make sense of it. They want everything to be coherent.
Sure.
And so I think what the three-eyed raven is trying to tell Bran is, look, maybe he heard you, or maybe he heard the wind. Who's to say? In either case, the ink is dry.
Whatever happened.
Yeah, that's right.
Sure, but there's always the concern that, like, okay, well, can, like, what is, like, as I don't, because I thought these were visions, which is, you know, again, I'm willing to accept, you know, I know it's odd, I'm willing to accept, you know, plugging into a tree and seeing the past. The idea of then plugging into a tree and potentially impacting the past, or even just being heard, whatever it is, like, even regardless of whether or not Ned can justify it was the wind, you can make the argument that if in fact it was Bran's voice that he heard, the butterfly effect is already in play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because no matter what, right? I mean, like, even if it's small, even if it's nothing, you know, even if that was enough for him to go, hey, you know what, I wasn't gonna have any kids, but why do I feel the need to be a father right now? I don't know.
Well, In any case, Steve, it's a fun thing to talk about. And
okay,
in a show that has smoke babies and dragons and fire visions and faceless men and zombies,
mm-hmm.
we're gonna have to incorporate time travel because.
Why do we have to? You gave a perfect explanation of why we've got plenty.
Mm-hmm. No, we need it all. We need everything, which is why I want Roose Bolton to be a vampire. And it's also why I want Varys to be a merman. I need all of it, Steve.
Okay. I mean, I'm going to get whatever they give me. It's just, it takes me out anytime that there's a time, like an interruption of time. It took me out.
So you didn't like it. You didn't like that. I think most people are kind of intrigued by it. It's like, ooh, this is an interesting theme to play.
Well, have these people never seen a time travel movie before? Have they not seen the problem?
In fact, I'm one of them. And you know what those people want? They want more time travel movies.
I don't understand. Because you know why? Because none of them work. And so you're waiting for someone to make it work.
Well, all right.
If I could go back in time, I would stop every time travel movie from.
No, you wouldn't. You can't tell me you've never seen a time travel movie that hasn't worked.
Yeah.
Looper?
Looper's great. It doesn't work.
Doesn't work. Is it Primer or Primer? I never know how to pronounce that.
Doesn't work. See what I'm going to do now?
Let me try to think of one that works. Back to the Future 3.
That's a bad movie. It's a bad film.
Why not? I thought that they solved the problems that were in 1 and 2.
It's funny because, like, as bad as 3 is, 2 benefits greatly from the existence of 3 because 2 is pretty bad. Like, 2 is really bad. They were smart to release 3 so quickly after 2 so that we didn't have the real opportunity to go, was 2 a piece of shit?
What hasn't been done enough, Steve, is time traveling with cowboys. I really feel like there's a lot that could be done there.
Bill and Ted is the only one that's ever worked.
Bill, so you're okay with Bill and Ted?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Man. All right, so John
leaves the wall, man. He executes yeah. Ollie and Alistair Thorne.
That's a pretty badass ending, man.
And just says, my watch is over.
Yeah, that's kind of, like, to be honest, that was the moment. Like, I think we all, I don't know about we all, but I know Heather and I, like, we just kind of were like, say it, say that the watch is ended. Hell yeah. Like, I don't know, I was pretty okay with it. I know that I was supposed to be moved by Ollie.
It was a great episode.
It really is. It's a real, real, season 6 has kind of been, you know, here we are, what, 3 in? And all of them feel like deeper episodes in a season.
You know what? Here's what I like.
Feeling rushed.
You can tell it's going well when, like, I had somewhat of a problem with Davos's play to lock himself in the room.
Uh-huh.
And you had somewhat of a problem with the whole timey-wimey business in this episode. Mm-hmm. But in both cases, it didn't ruin the episode. It was sort of like, I'm still in. I'll move on. I could do without Sam throwing up.
Oh, man. I laugh so hard. I love watching people throw up.
You love it, huh? That's interesting. Oh, yeah. Because I just think there's just got to be tons in there.
Oh my gosh, yeah, that's all. I mean, it was great.
He's just going to be a never-ending geyser of vomit.
He did a great job of conveying. Now, you don't get seasick, right?
I get it. I take Dramamine. It depends on how choppy it is.
Well, I like, it's great because he rallies to give a speech. And then as soon as the speech is over, he just yaks, and I'm like, dude, that's it. That is it. That's how you are in those situations. And sometimes,
see, that's
like,
how Davos trained all of those years at sea. He was giving speeches when he was really seasick. And if you can give a speech when you're seasick, then you've mastered the art of monologue.
Right. And that's the thing is, if you can give a speech when you're seasick, you're not going to get seasick. As soon as you're done giving a speech, you throw up. So if you make that speech a little redundant and maybe say the same thing a few more times to a few more people, the whole time, like, man, this guy won't shut up. And it's like, but he didn't throw up once.
Well, now that he's on land, he can just monologue whenever because he's not seasick anymore.
Yeah.
He's just like, I can do this forever and not vomit.
Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on a series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on the 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R. R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into season two.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
For this week's Bird's Eye View, I'll include a short clip of my conversation with Danielle Alessi. Danielle was a guest last week, and I got a lot of great feedback about her. I had an emailer ask about how math education worked in the medieval period. And so I read that email to Danielle, and I think we at least arrived at the start of an answer. I wanted to ask you a question, and I guess I'm kind of putting you on the spot because I probably should have given you a little bit of alert on this, but I think you might be able to help.
Sure.
This is from Leah, and of course, if you don't have an answer for Leah, we can always, you know, point her in the right direction or something like this.
Okay.
I'm really curious about how people learned math in the Middle Ages, and I hope you might talk about it. I was rewatching some old episodes that included Davos and Stannis talking about the numbers of people and ships and their armies, and I found myself wondering at what point in his life Davos, a man who never learned to read, learned math. Obviously, a smuggler needs to know the basics of finance, but who taught him? So, I've heard a lot of discussions about literacy in ancient times, or lack thereof, mm-hmm. but I wonder how many people were taught these more practical skills compared to our modern pedagogy.
Oh, wow. What a question.
It's a great question.
Yeah.
Thank you, Leah. And I'm crossing my fingers, hoping that Professor Alisi will be able to answer this for us.
Wow. I have never really gotten that question before. That's super interesting. I'm sure there's so much more research on this than what I have to offer. So I kind of hesitate to talk vaguely about what somebody has done a ton of work on. But I will say that, you know, someone like Davos wouldn't be really learning math in any formal setting. Mm. It would be kind of practical skills gained on the job. And that's something that we would expect to see more in the university level, the clergy, for people going to university, they would be doing a little bit more advanced training, mm-hmm. but still nothing like what we would think about now. I don't know of many medieval calculus mm-hmm. classes, for mm-hmm. example. A lot of that work and that knowledge was happening in the medieval period, but not necessarily in medieval Europe, maybe in places that had more Islamic influence in the Byzantine Empire.
Sure.
They were working in more in some of these areas, physicians, people at university, people in the clergy again, or just other philosophers, people working in science and math in ways that we don't see so much in mm-hmm. medieval Europe until a little bit later on when that knowledge kind of comes back and gets recovered
right.
through contact.
I did a little search for this a couple weeks back, and I just encountered, so Leah, you can look this up. Like, put this in your Google search engine, Math History, St. Andrews, Education Medieval. It's just a short article, but basically the authors of this little article, O'Connor and Robertson, are basically, they're saying is that upper crust folks who could afford it could hire like a math tutor that would focus on things like bookkeeping.
Yeah.
As far as like someone like Davos, yeah, probably not. It seems like probably not. And the exception is that this was an area of research among monks. Like they, mm-hmm. like if you were at a monastery, you might train in numbers.
Yeah.
So that would be a way for sort of a commoner to be exposed to this sort of thing.
Yeah. And we would also see, you know, and I don't know that this would apply to a smuggler like Davos, but mm-hmm. Guilds. Right. There'd right. be some they pass the knowledge down. Like I said, it's known practically, is learned practically from working in the field,
right.
learning what you need to know. Not really the advanced math we might be thinking of, but then that would get passed down, trained, right? As mm-hmm. you train as an apprentice and so on, you learn these skills. So, for the upper class, like you said, there'd be tutors, people who were learned in these things, but commonly, no, there wouldn't be some sort of like universal math education at this time.
Yeah. And it's a little bit like literacy in that, you know, even if you were illiterate, you could probably write your name.
Mm-hmm.
And let's say you're working construction, you could probably write down like a materials list.
Mm-hmm.
So if you were a soldier, you might learn just by being on the field.
Yeah.
That looks like about 2,000 tents. You know, you can kind of guess just because you're learning in a practical way, I suppose.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Well, thank you. I know that I sprung that on you.
Yeah.
But I think it's an interesting question.
Oh, it
because
is.
Because
yeah.
I think that she's totally right. We tend to focus on literacy as sort of a litmus test for educational prowess during this period.
Oh, yeah. And when you think about, you know, some of the structures that still stand today, the magnificent cathedrals built in that time, I mean, they knew something, right? They knew architecture. Absolutely. They knew the mathematics needed for that type of thing. I was just teaching on this the other day, Justinian building the Hagia Sophia in the Byzantine Empire. I mean, the work, the architecture work that went into that to create those spaces that brought in all the light, you know, right. I mean, that came from a Greek architect who knew math, right, from some of the older training. Right. So they definitely knew things. It's just how much does that trickle down?
Yeah, so the guilds are really passing on practical knowledge. It's very specific to, you know.
What's needed.
Exactly. That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for that. Absolutely. So, my thanks again to Danielle. If you're interested in seeing what else Danielle is doing, you can follow her on Twitter at Danielle_Alessi. That's A-L-E-S-I. And that is all for this week.